political correctness and diversity to take a hike, because diversity divides and assimilation brings unity. What we have now is a nation of Babel. Let's take back our country now. For KSCO and KOMY, this is Kay Swirling.
You're listening to Red Hot News Talk for the Central Coast, AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz, AM 1340 KOMY Watsonville, and KSCO.com worldwide. Scott Free here with your Central Coast weather forecast for today, Saturday, May 29th, 2004. It's going to be mostly sunny today with highs in the 60s at the coast, lower 80s inland, and northwest winds 5 to 10 miles an hour, increasing 10 to 20 miles per hour by this afternoon. Tonight's going to be mostly clear with some patchy low clouds and fog forming along the coast and in the valleys. Lows in the 40s to the lower 50s and northwest winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. And Sunday calls for mostly sunny conditions. It's going to be warmer interiors with highs in the 60s at the coast, lower 90s inland, and north winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. Memorial Day calls for mostly sunny conditions with highs in the 60s at the coast, lower 90s inland, and northwest winds 5 to 10 miles an hour, becoming west winds 5 to 15 miles per hour by the afternoon. So it sounds like Memorial Day, you should come on over to the coast because it's going to be nice and cool. All your friends are going to be coming out here, and we're going to be having a whole lot of fun. Boaters forecast calls for a small craft advisory through tonight, and that will continue until Sunday and into Sunday night. Winds west 5 to 25 knots. That's going to be strongest this afternoon with waves 2 to 4 feet and swells west 3 to 5 feet every 8 seconds. Currently, it is 58 degrees here at AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz. Stay tuned because it's time for a very special edition of the Saturday Special right here on AM 1080 KSCO.
Good morning! A brighter day is here. Good morning! May we bring you cheer.
We've got time, we've got tunes, we've got time, tunes, and temperature.
Get up and go, it's today, you know, on KSCO Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Welcome to the Saturday Special here on KSCO. I'm Charlie Friedman, hosting a program today with, it looks like, 8 now, World War II veterans and other war veterans who've gathered together to share some of their reminiscences and experiences with us on this occasion of the dedication of the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C.
Good morning. Now stay right here on KSCO Radio.
It's been 60 years since our boys stormed ashore on the beaches of Normandy, and it's time to do a little remembering. Join KSCO host and U.S. Navy veteran Charlie Friedman at 10 a.m. this Saturday for a very special Saturday special on World War II. Charlie's guests will include retired Cabrillo College journalism professor Bill Nolan, who served as an Army forward observer during the Battle of the Bulge. Howard Velliner, a Navy veteran of three wars who witnessed the Doolittle Raid on Tokyo. And Maurice Ricketts, World War II Navy veteran of the Atlantic and Pacific and author of As It Was. It's a look back at World War II this Saturday at 10 a.m. on the Saturday Special, right here on AM 1080 KSCO.
Mopping up soda pop rickets to our heart's delight.
Dance to swingaroo quickies, jukebox Saturday night.
Goodman and Kaiser and Miller help to make things bright.
Make some hot licks with vanilla. Saturday night.
Well, to the sounds of Glenn Miller, we open today's program. Entirely appropriate. You're going to love this. I brought in a Glenn Miller LP. I didn't bother bringing in the 78s. I have them, of course. But I figured, oh, these shavetails around here, they won't even know what a 78 is. So I brought in an LP, figuring no problems. You know, these individuals don't even have a turntable in the control room. Had to use some kind of a little compact disc, they call it. Those things aren't records. Oh, well, somebody has to be a Mossback, and that's me. I'm Charlie Friedman. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Saturday Special. We have a group of people here that keeps getting bigger by the minute. When I came into the radio station about 9 o'clock to be early and kind of get acquainted with the people that we're going to have in, Howard was here, Bill was here, and Chuck was here, and we sat around and talked for a while, and then other people started showing up. Walter came in, Joe came in, Ricketts came in, and so now what we're going to do, I've got, let me see, 7 warm bodies around here, all of whom have some interesting things to share with us, and we're going to just go around the table, please. I'll start on my left here, like I would if I was dealing poker, and we'll ask Howard Bittner to say a few things about his experiences. Earlier he was telling me that he served on the USS Enterprise, aircraft carrier, the most highly decorated ship in the entire war, more battle stars than any other. Is that correct, sir?
The Enterprise got 20 battle stars during World War II.
Okay, and you had also mentioned being involved in actually on the ship prior to Pearl Harbor. You were in the Navy, one of those people who was in the military even before Pearl Harbor.
Yes, I was assigned to the USS Enterprise 10 months before December 7th.
Outstanding. And you were also talking about the fact that due to the destroyers and the swells, you had the privilege of missing being at Pearl Harbor Sunday, December 7th, for which I congratulate you.
Yeah, well, I congratulate myself on that one. It was Admiral Halsey that went to half speed because the swells were burying the noses of the destroyers. And he, being an old tin can sailor, thought it'd be better to slow down. Otherwise, we'd have been tied up unscheduled at F9 at Pearl Harbor on Saturday night. The USS Utah, a target ship, was tied up at F11, and we dropped practice bombs on that as a target ship, and her decks were covered with planks.
Timbers, yeah, to pad her against the shock.
And, of course, the Japanese had intelligence, I'm sure, that the Enterprise would be there, so it was assumed that the Utah was the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
They put 3 torpedoes into her.
They expended a lot of ordnance sinking a target ship, and the Utah turned over like the Oklahoma did.
That's true.
Wound up face down in the mud there. Let's go to our next gentleman, and this is one of the people who came in. You want to grab that microphone and push it over there, please. And you came in just as we were starting to go on the air. I didn't get a chance to get your name.
It is
Bud Murray.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little about yourself and your experiences, please, sir?
Well, I was in the infantry. I was 37th Ohio. And we started out at Guadalcanal, went up through the Solomons to Bougainville, spent about a year on Bougainville, and then went from there to the invasion of Luzon, the Philippine Islands. But it was all on foot.
So you did the island hopping?
Yeah, did the island hopping. That's the way MacArthur wanted to do, to cut off the Japanese, and also allow for bombers to get up to the top island or closer island to any of the active islands by the Japanese.
I understand what they tried to do there as much as possible was to leapfrog the stronger. There was, as I recall, the Japanese had a very important base at Truk. And we never even attempted to take that. We simply bypassed it and allowed it to rot on the vine, so to speak.
I wouldn't say they bypassed it. They bombed that pretty regular. It was a well-built fortress, extremely well-built. And the Jap fleet was in there. In fact, they just come down with what they call the slot and go after our troop ships and that type of thing. But we never went into Truk. Never even bothered with Truk. Went right on by. In fact, we didn't even go up in front of it. We went right around by New Guinea.
Right.
Yeah.
Bombed the daylights out of it, but never bothered to stage an invasion.
No.
Let's go to our next gentleman here, Mr. Walter Brown. This is another one of the people who came in not too long before broadcast time. If you'd be so kind as to share some of your experiences with us, please, sir.
Well, I was a volunteer draftee, but anyway, I saw a lot of action.
You know, that's an interesting term. How do you be a volunteer draftee?
Well, I had 2B deferment. I worked on ships. Anyway, I was on Omaha Beach, D-Day, H hour. We were towed behind LSTs, 100 yards by cable. And since it was hard to get equipment in, we had to get in front of the LST and take all the equipment in. So, anyway, after the invasion of Normandy, we were shipped to the Pacific, and I was attached to the Dutch East Indian troops and the Australian troops, and we did their road work and everything, getting equipment ashore from LSTs, and I finally wound up in North China doing occupation duty.
So it sounds to me like you were a specialist in amphibious landings.
Yes.
And whenever they had an operation like that, whether it happened to be in Europe for D-Day or then after that was through, they brought you halfway around the world to do the same thing all over again against the Japanese.
Right.
What in particular did you facilitate? An amphibious landing is a very complicated thing. What was your particular specialty?
Well, I was on a bulldozer, and when we got ashore, because trucks and everything would be, and equipment would be all blown up, we had to find a path through there, and the bulldozer was used to help make sure that nothing got stuck, and we could push it aside so they could get into where they wanted to go.
Sounds absolutely essential. Without the work you did, things would just stack up on the beach and be cut to pieces.
Right.
Thank you very much. Move on to our next gentleman here, Maurice Ricketts. He introduces himself as Rick.
Okay. Hello. You want a quick rundown?
If you would, please.
Well, I was an orphan kid in Wyoming, you know, and I needed a place to sleep and to eat, you know, because I was trying to make my own living. When I was just on my 17th birthday, I was in the National Guard Cavalry, the last of the horse cavalry. And I went one little encampment in Centralia, Washington, and I'd be damned if I wanted to go to war on a horse. So after the 29 days, I come back and I enlisted in the regular Navy for 6 years. And I was in boot camp the same time Howard was. And out of boot camp, I got on the USS Enterprise for a short ride to Pearl Harbor. And there I was assigned to a destroyer. And the destroyers, they sent 14 of them over to the North Atlantic to do cash carry lend-lease. So made one convoy to Iceland, one convoy to Scotland, and to Bermuda, and then was on a big convoy that we left with 21,000 British and Canadian troops on the way to Singapore. And when Pearl Harbor was bombed, I was already one day out of Cape Town, South Africa. So my first year in the Navy, I went everywhere. I had the USS Winslow DD-359.
Join the Navy and see the world was true in your case.
Yeah, I dropped a lot of depth charges on U-boats in the North Atlantic. And we'd leave sometime on the convoy, and we wouldn't have a space on our deck for anything else but depth charges.
You mentioned Lend-Lease. I'm sure most of our listeners are probably familiar with the story of how President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill worked out the agreement for Lend-Lease, which involved the United States ceding to the British 50, that is 50 overage destroyers. Overage, most of them were old four-stackers. Was the ship you were on?
No, mine wasn't the four-stacker. It was one of the key ships in the destroyer Navy at that time. It was eight guns, four 25-inch mounts.
So this was not an overage ship at all.
This is one of the key ships at the time on the destroyer. A flotilla leader. It was only four built at the time. So they sent us every. I was on the, when the Atlantic Charter was made, I seen the Prince of Wales come in. It just got through running from the Bismarck, and it brought Churchill in to meet Roosevelt and Newfoundland, Agentia.
Okay.
And all we did is waller in the wake of that thing. When showing off, he was showing off. He'd come in full speed and reverse the props and turned up the bottom. And you know, they're famous for their ritual and their stuff like that, the British.
All of which goes to prove that landlubbers have no monopoly on hot rodding.
Right.
Let's move to our next gentleman now, Chuck Jugun, who was a tail gunner on one of the B-24 Liberators that used to fly over the Third Reich, dropping little billet-doux here and there. Chuck, thank you for coming, and what can you tell us?
Well, I was in the United States Navy as a tail gunner in World War II. And our squadron was primary high-altitude photographic. We had orders from the fleet to get out in front of everybody and map what was going on. So when they decided to make an attack, they knew what was on the ground there for their ships or aircraft to bring the right ordnance to make sure it was gone.
Yeah, I'm really sorry this isn't color radio, because a couple of these gentlemen have brought in some very interesting photographs and things, and you had one in particular you showed me that that actually showed your plane, the picture taken from another aircraft, I guess, on one of your missions. You also had one that was absolutely stunning of a B-17 still in the air. What was it, B-24? I beg your, it had four engines. The one with that had the tail blown off?
We had four engines in our aircraft.
B-24 is a four engine.
B-24 had four engines.
I keep mixing it up with a B-25. My fault, sorry. But the thing is, the aircraft was still in the air, but the tail section was completely gone. The plane had been hit, and you still had the wings, the fuselage, and about two-thirds of the fuselage and the rest of the airplane gone. And how in the world did somebody manage to get such an incredibly dramatic picture in just that moment?
Well, I was very, very lucky, because when any aircraft gun hits you in the right spot, they got to chop you in half, and that's what happens to them. And so we flew our planes, like I say, 1,000,000 miles. That's 9 planes squadron, and that's a long way. And we flew 20,000 feet at almost all the time.
What speed did you generally cruise at?
Well, if everybody leaned forward, we was doing about 250
knots.
That's what I thought,
about 250.
Yeah, so
I'd like to interject here for just a moment. This is kind of, it's slightly off the subject, but not entirely. If any of you in the radio audience are interested in these vintage aircraft, these World War II Air Hawks, right now, today and tomorrow, the annual fly-in in Watsonville is going on, and they always bring in a number of warbirds, and there's, for the first time I can remember, and I lived in Watsonville forever, there's fantastic weather for the fly-ins, just these crystal clear, beautiful blue skies. It's going to be an incredible day over there. If you're casting about for something to do today that would be interesting, entertaining, educational, and just a tremendous rewarding experience, steam over to Watsonville and check out the warbirds there and the other aircraft they're going to have. They're going to have aerobatics and everything else under the sun. Next person we have is another one of our later arrivals. Is it Riney Ness?
Riney Ness, yes.
Riney Ness, yes. Could you tell us a little bit about your experiences, please?
My experience was I was drafted. And I was
greetings from the President of the United States.
Right. And I was 7 days in the service before Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
At the Presidio Monterey, waiting to be shipped out.
So you're a local yokel, huh?
Right.
Come from around here, do you? Great.
Yes, I was drafted in Santa Cruz here.
Okay, and when they did ship you out, where did you wind up?
From Presidio, we went to Fort Knox, Kentucky for our training.
Basic in Fort Knox.
Basic. Mm-hmm. And after basic, went to Camp Chaffee, Arkansas, to form a new division, the 6th Armored. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was formed in Fort Knox, but we moved to Camp Chaffee to get the new troops in. And from there, we went to Louisiana maneuvers for 2 or 3 weeks, back to Chaffee, out to the Mojave Desert for about 2 or 3 months, then to Camp Cook, California, the last station, for some time for training. Then we went to New York and wound up in England, a little town called Chipping Norton, about 18 miles from Oxford, England. Mm-hmm. And from there, we trained, went down to Wales for effect, firing effect on our tank guns. We had Shermans with 76 millimeter guns on it. We went down, fire for effect in that. And then we went back and waited for D-Day, and went to D-Day, and started went through different towns. I can't remember them anymore, but I remember Frankfurt, where we crossed the river and that, and I definitely remember Battle of the Bulge.
Okay.
To me, well, Churchill said that was the biggest battle in Europe at that time. Mm-hmm. The information I got later on. So after we went to the Battle of the Bulge and went to Germany, then the war ended.
Now, who were you working for, Omar Bradley or Patton?
We were under Patton.
Patton. So you were Third Army.
Third Army.
Yes, sir.
Did I make it clear I was in the 6th Armored Division?
I didn't realize that was part of Third Army. I don't.
Yes, 6th Armored Division, 68 Tank Battalion, Charlie Company. That was my company. It's a medium tank company.
So you were going across Europe lickety-split.
Fast as we could.
As long as they give you gasoline.
That's right.
We're going to take a little break right now. We still have one more person we need to meet, but just now we need to conform to the exigencies of the clock. I'm Charlie Friedman. This is the Saturday Special with a group of war veterans. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
News you can use and talk that's red hot. KSCO, Santa Cruz, San Jose, Salinas, and Monterey.
Over $3 million of fine art jewelry, Rolex watches, gold coins, Persian rugs, historical documents, luxury furs, collectible and bronze sculptures must be sold at Liquidation Auction this Saturday, May 29th. United States Liquidators is auctioning original works of art by Pablo Picasso, Joan Miró, Raúl Dufay, Maurice Utrillo, Camille Pissarro, Louis Eichardt, H. Behrens, Tarkai, H. Claude, and Palomil Pissarro, and more. Original bronze sculptured by Angelo Basso and Ert. Pencils signed Picasso, Chagall, Miró, Dalí, and others. Over 20 Armani, Yadro, Hummel, and Santini figurines. Over 200 lots of fine jewelry, large certified diamond solitaires, 2 to 15 carats. Rolex Presidentials, Cartier, Patek Philippe, Piaget, and others. Masterpiece, handmade rugs, Tabriz, Isfahan, Kashan, Kerman, Ariz, and more. All to be offered at auction this Saturday, May 29th, in the Seascape Resort Aptos. Preview at noon starts at 1 p.m. Most items sold with no minimum and no reserve. For more information, call 1-800-738-6790. 1-800-738-6790.
My name is Kathy, and I met my husband Michael at eHarmony.com.
My name is Gina, and I met my husband Tom through eHarmony.com.
My name's Jennifer, and I met my husband, Jack, on eHarmony.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Neil Clark Warren, founder of eHarmony.com. These are just a few of the hundreds of eHarmony marriages. Dating services give you a picture and a paragraph. We go a lot deeper. We start with a personality profile that features 29 dimensions of compatibility, crucial to a long-term relationship. And if you go to eHarmony.com right now, we'll give you this $40 profile free. And then we'll find you a soulmate based on compatibility in the most important areas of life. Visit eHarmony.com today. Get your free personality profile.
My name is Becky, and I met my husband, Tom, on eHarmony.com.
A lot of happy guys out there tonight, thanks to eHarmony.com.
America is a country of entrepreneurs, so it should come as no surprise that if you're a small business owner, you're helping shoulder the lion's share of the U.S. economy, and that's no easy load. Good thing you can lighten it a little at Sam's Club. Sam Walton created Sam's Club to give small business owners the purchasing power of big businesses. So no matter what kind of small business you own, when you shop at Sam's Club, you get everyday low costs on items you need every day. And to save you time, we offer click and pull and fax and pull. Convenient services to help you order ahead for fast pickup. Place your order online at samsclub.com or by fax before 5 p.m. And at no extra charge, it's ready to pick up the next morning. Now that's teamwork. And we're proud to be a small part of your team. After all, while you may be carrying around the weight of the American economy, you shouldn't have to do all the heavy lifting by yourself. Sam's Club. We are in business for small business.
Uh,
that, we come back on the air. This is Charles Friedman. It's the Saturday Special, and it's a special program today in honor of World War II veterans in particular, on the occasion of the dedication of the World War II Veterans Monument in Washington, D.C. Join the Capitola Mall and KSCO-KOMY in celebration of our veterans' service to the USA on Flag Day, Monday, June 14th. That's also Bastille Day, at 11 a.m. in the food court at the mall. That would be July 14th. Wrong again, June 14th. Join area veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and Desert Storm, Iraq. After a flag ceremony and introduction of representative veterans, a free lunch will be served to veterans, free ice cream, and patriotic gifts for all. The Dizzy Burnett and Grover Coe Band will play swing music from 12 to 2 p.m. Bring your fellow veterans, family, and friends, wear your dancing shoes, and some red, white, and blue. For further information, contact Michael Olson. Here at KSCO, the phone number is 475-1080. Well, we have so many gentlemen here who showed up that between the beginning of the program and our first break, we didn't quite complete it. We have Bill Nolan, who still needs to introduce himself and tell us a little bit about himself. And Bill, thank you very much for coming, and what can you offer us today?
Well, the thing that strikes me as most important about my experience with the military is that I started out in field artillery, ROTC, reserve officer training, at the University of Oklahoma many years ago, back in the 30s, and we had horse-drawn artillery. And now, those of you who watch TV know that nearly all this sort of fighting is done with radar and satellite technology and GPS, whatever that means. So there's no use for the kind of person I was during World War II, because I was in field artillery, the 106th Infantry Division field artillery, the 591st Battalion, and my task as the youngest officer in the outfit was a forward observer, being with or ahead of the infantry looking for Nazi targets, especially when the infantry were going to attack the next town. I would go to a high hill or the top of a high building, occasionally a church steeple, which was verboten, but I did it occasionally, and direct the fire at the targets. So that's about it. The Battle of the Bulge was the major part of my experience in Europe. And I've learned so much here from listening to these guys who were in the Pacific. We are inundated with Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers, and seems that most of the interest in World War II in this country is on Europe and not so much on the Pacific. So it's been a good lesson for me today to learn something about the great work that these guys did in the Pacific, which we don't hear much of.
Doesn't make as good a movie, I guess.
No.
Well, thank you very much, Bill. Right now, take a couple of seconds to respond to a couple of telephone inquiries we've had from some of you who are listening. In case, incidentally, you have something you'd like to address to one of these gentlemen, a question, a comment, something of that nature, let me give the telephone number. It's 479-1080. That is 479-1080. And this is a program where we do solicit and respond to audience input. So if you have something you want to ask, something you want to contribute, or anything else for that matter, please don't hesitate to give us a call at 479-1080, and we'll be happy to have your contribution to the program. Mary wants to know if any of the people know about a ship, the USS Rudderow, a destroyer escort. I asked around during the break, and nobody does, but it was suggested that you might go online and try doing a Google search under the title, the name of the ship. It mentions here that you might not be sure of the spelling. That's one thing you'd have to ascertain, is how to spell the name of the ship and make sure that you do it correctly. You might have to try several different times, changing the spelling each time until you get it right. But this is a possible source of information for you. Now, we had another person from Aptos indicating that their father had talked about C and K rations. And when I asked what's the difference, Bud Murray jumped right in and said, well, I can tell you a little bit about that. So if you'll pass that microphone over to Bud Murray, perhaps you can go ahead and tell us what you were telling us during the break about the difference between C rations and K rations, please.
Well, this, the C ration is cans of food that they handed out. When you went on patrol or you went on an attack, you'd carry 6 to 8 cans of C.
Mm-hmm.
And you carry them in the back, and there are 3 different varieties of them in that. But as far as I'm concerned, they weren't worth a damn. But
would they keep you alive?
That's the extent. Well, they had what they called a candy bar. And you're supposed to take one little square of that per day. Well, hell, we sit and eat the whole darn thing. It wouldn't bother us, but they're so nutritious in that. Your C, your K ration is in a little box. Oh, I would say it was about 6 inches by about 2 inches thick and 4 inches wide. And you had a meal in there. It was a dry meal. You could have that in... Then your E is a great point. It's called the 10-in-1, what we call 10 men for a day or 1 man for 10 days, but I don't know how you carry them. They're in a great big, huge box. I don't know how in the world you could carry them.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the different rationing that they had in those days.
By golly, how about that? Somebody did that Google search. We do have some information about the USS Rudderow. Can't read because I got the wrong glasses on. Here we go. NavSource Online, Destroyer Escort, Photo Archive, DE-224, USS Rudderow, RUDDEROW. 1,450 tons, 306 feet by 36 feet beam, 2.5-inch, 440 millimeter. There are a couple of pictures here. And they're just official Navy photos, the kind that you'd normally expect to see of ships that generally after a ship is commissioned, when it's newly commissioned, they take a few official photos of it. And that looks like what we have here. So if you look online, you're going to be able to find something about this. And this particular ship was laid down at the Philadelphia Navy Yard, 1943, commissioned May 1944, decommissioned 1947, stricken November 1969 and sold for scrap October 1970. So she has become razor blades, as we say in the Navy.
I think that maybe they were wondering what type of maneuvers that ship went out on. Where did it go? What did it accomplish for the war?
There are no details of that in this particular report here. I would suggest that the lady, Mary, who's interested in this, go online yourself and possibly you can get some additional information. But on this particular sheet here, all there are is specifications, size, dates, and that's the end of that. But there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to find additional information online. Again, the spelling, USS Rudderow, RUDDEROW. One thing I wanted to, let me see. Is it about time? Yeah, why don't we take a break here? And when we come back, Howard Bittner had a few interesting things to say about the Doolittle raid. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the fact that Jimmy Doolittle took some... B-25s off of an aircraft carrier and bombed Tokyo very early in the war. And he had some things to say about that that I certainly didn't know, and I don't think you do either. So when we get back, we'll talk a little about that. Right now, we're going to take a break on the Saturday special. If you want to call us, 479-1080.
The apple tree with anyone else but me till I come marching home.
We feel it the first day our kids learn the word no. We're reminded of it every time we read the headlines or when doing battle with the stack of papers on our desk. But before the world defeats us, maybe it's time to consider another way. Hello, I'm Meg Lumsdaine, host of the Leap to Faith radio program, with an invitation to join me and my guests, Pastors Clark Brown and Herb Schmidt, as we discuss the promised powers for those who believe. We'll talk about what transformed the disciples of Jesus to change their world and see how we can overcome the barriers to the Spirit that keep us bound. It's Leap to Faith, Saturday at 2 p.m. on 1080 KSCO. Ladies, how would you like to be a member of a family-run business? How would you like to belong to a health club that focuses on you in a warm and friendly atmosphere? Well, I'm Teresa, and I'm the owner of Go Figure Fitness for Women in downtown Santa Cruz. Go Figure is not a franchise or tied into one. We're the small fish in the big sea. Our members are number one to us, and we'll take great care of you. Go Figure is an all-women's health club that focuses on the whole woman, including your nutritional needs. A membership at Go Figure includes one-on-one personal training, weight loss and nutrition counseling, along with the ever-so-popular 30-minute circuit with no hidden fees. Go Figure carries the complete line of the American Longevity products. So come join a club that takes care of the whole woman and is member-friendly. Go Figure, located in downtown Santa Cruz. Call 426-3948. Again, the number is 426-3948.
An XM satellite radio listener gets commercial-free music day one.
Spend time listening to all of XM's music channels today, especially jazz and hip-hop. Not a single commercial break, so I couldn't call my girlfriend Allison.
Allison versus XM, day two.
Woke up with head on table next to XM radio. Ears felt good, but neck was a little stiff. Spent 12 straight hours listening to commercial-free punk rock channel. Forgot to call Allison again. We'll send flowers tomorrow.
XM 1, Allison 0, day 6.
Four voicemails from Allison. We'll call her back after Springsteen Marathon.
I'm rooting for you, Allison. Day 12.
Allison called, said if I'm not dead, we're through. We'll call her back just as soon as they break for a commercial.
Don't hold your breath, Allison, because all of XM's music channels are 100% commercial-free. And this year, you get over 120 digital channels of music, news, sports, and talk. Check it out at stores like Best Buy and Circuit City. XM Satellite Radio. Required monthly subscription and hardware sold separately. Activation fee applies.
Hi, this is Don Fredrickson from GotNet. GotNet specializes in business services. Whether you need a T1 or T3 or just a place to host your website, GotNet has a solution to fit your needs. GotNet offers server colocation and custom website development. We have e-commerce servers, streaming audio and video servers, and cold fusion and database servers available to handle your hosting needs. GotNet understands that businesses rely on the Internet, and we work hard to assure fast, reliable service. Call GotNet today at 460-2000. Food, shelter, clothing, net. GotNet.
I need you for a mission I've been ordered to put together. You know what top secret is?
Yes, sir. It's the kind of mission where you get medals. But they send them to your relatives.
Top secret means you train for something never done before in aviation history. And you go without knowing where you're going. You do it on that basis or not at all?
I'll go, sir. I'll go too, sir.
And we're back once again to the sounds of the Glenn Miller Orchestra, certainly the musical voice of that early 40s period. Unfortunately, he was one of the people who didn't come back from World War II. We were talking earlier about friendly fire accidents. I guess the latest information they have, they actually found the airplane in the English Channel. They found the airplane that that Miller had been flying in. And the story is that as the bombers would come back from their runs over Europe, any unexpended ordnance would be jettisoned over the English Channel, and that it was altogether possible that this small plane that Miller was flying in might have actually been knocked out of the sky by splashes from ordnance being jettisoned by returning aircraft. Any of you heard anything about this, or is this something that that I spotted in the paper that you guys didn't? Nope, nobody knows anything about it? Well, I'm wondering. We just heard... Scott played a little thing about people who were leaving for an air mission and not knowing where they were going and et cetera. And one of the tightest security circles ever drawn around any air mission was drawn around Jimmy Doolittle's Tokyo raid. And we do have a gentleman here who was part of Task Force 16, the task force that was responsible for getting the Doolittle Raiders out. And I had always thought that the only carrier involved in that was USS Hornet. And Howard Bittner is here to tell me that USS Enterprise was in on that, too.
Not only in on it, but led it. The after the Doolittle raid occurred, the Japanese asked, where did the aircraft come from? Franklin Delano Roosevelt answered, Shangri-La.
Shangri-La, of course, was a fictitious place from a
James Hilton novel, Lost Horizon.
Lost Horizon.
Yeah, you betcha.
I almost said New Horizon. But at any rate, the story sort of went out that the Hornet played its part and so on and so on. However, 50 years afterwards, the whole story came out, and I was sent an award for being part of Task Force 16, participation in Task Force 16. I was on the Enterprise. Now, there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 ships in each outfit called and a oiler and a submarine in each one, the Thresher and the Trout. But anyway, the Enterprise headed up one of the groups, and Hornet headed up the other group, and that made up the task force. Two battle forces made up a task force with eight ships in, cruisers and destroyers. Admiral Halsey was aboard the Enterprise and was in charge of the task force. The B-25s, 16 of them, once they were spotted on the deck of the Hornet, prevented any action because the wingspan was too big to go up and down the elevators to the hangar deck. Mm-hmm. Therefore, all searches and things of that nature had to be done by the Enterprise.
Enterprise's air group. What was the date that they that the Doolittle Raiders took off and dropped their bombs over Tokyo?
That was on the 18th of April, 1942.
Okay, so this is about the time of the Battle of the Coral Sea.
I believe it was just after, or it was just before that.
Okay, and this is why. So Hornet and Enterprise were busy doing this, and let me see, it was Yorktown and Saratoga who were down south taking part in the Battle of Coral Sea. At that time, we had only, no, Yorktown and Lexington, pardon me. At that time, we had only five aircraft carriers, and they were stretched extremely thin.
Right. Before the war was over, they were not only stretched thin, they were sunk.
Yeah, well, they were replaced, though, thank God. I mean, for once we got our shipbuilding capabilities online, we were able to build enough aircraft carriers to literally drown the Japanese. Admiral Yamamoto understood that that would happen, though. He had, unlike many of the other Japanese leaders, he had actually spent time here in the United States. He'd gone to school here and understood not only what the American industrial plant was like, but also what the American people were like. And it was after he got the news of the success at Pearl Harbor that he said, "I fear all we have done is to awaken a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve." He didn't know how right he was. One thing I was curious about, this is just from my own information, but by golly, I've got to ask this. We heard one gentleman, that was Rainey, who was talking about being in various stations around the country before being sent overseas, and I'm sure that everybody probably had that experience of conducting some training here, there, and everywhere. We see and hear about so many of the entertainers who went out, Glenn Miller, for example, who wound up losing his life trying to get his band over to Paris. I was amazed to learn that Kay Kaiser played more USO shows than anybody else up to and including Bob Hope. Did any of you ever get a chance to see any of these shows that the USO sponsored and that went out? And
yeah.
We've got one. Chuck, who did you have an opportunity to see?
When we were stationed at NOE Talk on our forward base, Bob Hope slept in there one beautiful sunshiny day, and we was going to see him that evening. We just had coconut logs to set on for our seats. And it rained cats and dogs, so we just sat out there and enjoyed every bit of it. It was just wonderful. And I appreciate him taking all that time he did. And they talking about his birthday coming up, anniversary of his birthday, and they're playing a lot of his music and programs he was on. I loved him. He was very, very good.
Who was with his troop at that? Did he have Colonna with him and Francis
Colonna
Langford?
With him and Francis Langford and Colonna, both were with him.
I love the professor.
Yeah,
I love the professor. He's
he
one
was
of my
real
favorites.
Sharp.
And somebody else raised a hand. Bill, you had an opportunity. Was this while you were in Europe?
Yeah.
fortunately, I didn't have to sit in the rain. I was Bob Hope in the Paris Opera House, which was nice, comfortable seats.
Oh, geez. What a great venue.
Yeah.
Now, when was this?
Oh, it must have been early in 45.
Early 45, okay. So by that time, the Battle of the Bulge was over with.
Yeah, that was during December of 44 and January of 45.
So this was kind of a nice dessert after hell and high water you had to go through.
Yeah.
Anybody?
We didn't hear any on USS Winslow and USS Alfred A. Cunningham. We didn't have the opportunity to see Bob Hope or any of them, but we had our sonar officer was Eddie Duchin. He's a famous piano player.
Yeah, sure. He started out with Leo Reisman, led his own band.
Yeah,
his son Peter wound up being fairly...
And Christmas 1945, he played the piano, and we all tried to sing, you know, with a lot of torpedo juice and vodka and stuff.
Torpedo juice. Did you actually tap the torpedoes? You know, they won't work if you take the alcohol out of them.
Yeah, I know that. But, over in Okinawa, your torpedo juice was a prime thing. You could make a few dollars if you sold some torpedo juice. And they were drinking everything they can think of, you know, shaving lotions.
Vitalis.
Yeah, all of that.
Boys will be boys. Oh, it brings me back a couple of my own memories of when Scott introduced the program. He mentioned I was a military veteran myself. I am a Vietnam era veteran. By a Vietnam era veteran, what that means is I was in the service at that time, but I was never in combat. And we were talking about that a while ago, and I mentioned this. This is the way I went about dodging the draft back in 1969 or 1971, rather. I was eligible for the draft. And I decided that I certainly didn't want to evade my commitment to my country. On the other hand, I wasn't crazy about the idea of being shot at, and these gentlemen here informed me that it's not really the most pleasant thing in the world, and I believe them. So I figured if I joined the Navy, I had a good chance of being able to have a little more to say about where I went and what I did, and it worked out that way, for which I'm eternally grateful. But I spent 6 years on the USS Oklahoma City, which was a light cruiser commissioned in 1943. The ship was actually a World War II veteran, and she was part of the Cleveland class of light cruisers, and by that time was flagship of the 7th Fleet. And the nice thing about being on a flagship, the Admiral likes to go to good liberty ports and have all kinds of interesting things go on in those places. Let me see. We've got a couple of calls here. Why don't we take one, let me see, Rich in Watsonville. Rich, did you want to ask something about of these gentlemen?
Hey.
Yeah.
Charlie, good morning.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, it's a shame that these guys have got honorable discharges. They're not lifers, and they can't go to the commissary or to the exchange once a month.
That's not true. Some of them are career people.
No, I'm just saying that as a whole, for the most part, I think all of them should get that privilege. But yesterday, I actually went to the commissary. The local VFW from, I guess, the seaside there, were selling these little carnations. And I don't know if any of you guys know what I'm talking about. At the front door there, as you go in, there's a 100% ID check. You know, when you're going into a store, you don't usually have your spare change with you. I asked these guys why they didn't move over to the door where they were exiting, where all the customers were exiting out of the commissary so they could, you know, hand them their spare change and get their little carnations. The manager of the store wouldn't let them do that. They were taking up too much room. They were in the way. I came out of the store about 20 minutes later. These old guys in wheelchairs and canes and crutches and all this stuff are loading up into a van, and they're just getting ready to leave because they have not sold anything.
Well, I'll tell you what, Rich. I ran into one of these gentlemen. They're poppies they're selling.
Poppies, there you go.
And, of course, the thing I had to ask him is if it was the same kind that the Wicked Witch used to put Dorothy to sleep. And he said no, but he was perfectly happy to sell me one. And I bought one over in Freedom, out in front of the Freedom Post Office. But I think we can all agree that any storekeeper or businessman who would begrudge these veterans
space
to conduct those activities ought to be horsewhipped.
Yeah, I do too. I'm wondering why the VFW and Freedom today is even having a garage sale out on the parking lot. I guess they're trying to sell tools or something. Maybe Maybe they're going to try and make some money, but
well, listen,
you know, this thing
Rich,
going on.
Hang on a second. Michael Olson is telling me that Bill Nolan has something to say about this, and I'm sure we'd be interested in hearing what that would be. Bill, do you have something to add on this subject?
Well, the several veterans organizations, we don't say they're selling the poppies. They are Flanders Field poppies, or supposed to represent those. From World War One days, when the guys, the trench warfare, the infantry really had hell, and they saw these little red poppies that grew wild or reseeded themselves in the grain fields in Flanders fields. And it's been the custom of most veterans organizations to offer these around Memorial Day each year, ever since I can remember, and that's nearly 80 years that I can remember them. And they, I don't like the idea of saying they're for sale. They're just there to remind people of what veterans have done, and that there are still veterans in hospitals and homes, and widows and orphans of veterans who need care that the government doesn't provide. And so we accept donations, and it doesn't matter how large or small the donation. And at least the VFW post from Aptus, of which I'm a member, will be out again today. We were out yesterday, mm-hmm. and at Knob Hill in Capitola, and the Deluxe Market in Deer Park in Aptus, and at the Aptus Post Office, our post at least, and other posts in the American Legion, and all are doing the same thing in many locations. And we do get excellent support from the public. Yesterday I was at Deluxe in Deer Park, and a good many $20 bills fell into my big gallon mayonnaise jar.
That's what I like to hear. Well, thank you for clarifying that, Bill. And thanks for the question, Rich, because that enabled us to get this word out. But yeah, when I talked with the gentleman who was over at Freedom, he made it clear that this wasn't a sale operation going on. This was rather solicitation of contributions and just a public outreach type of thing. Rick, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yes,
to that?
I'm not sold them. Asked for donations. Usually have a sealed can about the size of a beer can with a little slot, and you just hand them one of the poppies. And if they feel that they should donate, they do. Most people will donate. So I've did a little charity work in past that way.
Outstanding. We got a couple of minutes before the top of the hour, and we do have a caller on the line, so let's go ahead and work him in. This is Jeff in Carmel, and according to the note I see, Jeff, you want to raise a question about the Merchant Marine?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd like to thank you guys for serving our country.
Amen to that.
Even though you were trying to kill my grandfather, who was in the Wehrmacht. But anyway, I wanted to ask about the, you know, Memorial Day, we often forget about the Merchant Marine, and they took a lot of casualties, too. And I don't know if you guys know anything about those fellows or would like to talk about them. I'd like to hear it.
Does anybody here have a story or some kind of information that they could offer about the Merchant Marine or people who were in it? No, it looks like most of the folks here were doing other things, Jeff.
Yeah, I just,
but it's a good point you're making.
Yeah, they did take a lot of casualties, and I just like not to forget them, because I think they served our country, honorably, and took a lot of risk.
Well, no question about it. I just the other day I recall, and thanks incidentally for the call, appreciate it. Just the other day I was talking to a fellow. As a matter of fact, I believe it was the guy in front of Freedom Post Office that I got that poppy from. And let me see. His story was that he'd been turned down by the Merchant Marine for being underweight, but that when he went over to the Army recruiter, they said, "Oh yeah, sure, we'll take you." Mm-hmm. So I guess they were a little bit less choosy, and so they got his services instead of the Merchant Marine. We're coming up to 11 o'clock right now, halfway through our program today. I do want to remind you once again that there's going to be a Flag Day celebration of area veterans. Join at the Capitola Mall, KSCO and KOMY, in support of veteran services to the USA on Flag Day. That is Monday, June 14th. All veterans are welcome. If you have veterans in your family, please bring them down. And there's going to be entertainment, swing music, and food, ice cream, all kinds of interesting things going on. Once again, that is Flag Day, June 14th, 11 a.m. in the food court at the Capitola Mall. We will be back with you in another 5 minutes or so here on the Saturday Special. I'm Charles Friedman with seven World War II veterans, people who served in every theater from the Pacific on aircraft carriers to in the infantry at the Battle of the Bulge. We have people who were who took active part in the D-Day landing, helped facilitate that. So there are some people here who really perform services above and beyond the call. We'll be back with them in about 5 minutes. If you want to call and be part of the program, it's 479-1080.
The mission I'm asking you to volunteer for is exceptionally dangerous. Take a look at the man beside you. It's a good bet that in the next 6 weeks, you or he will be dead. Everyone brave enough to accept this, step forward.
You're listening to a very special edition of the Saturday Special here on AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz, AM 1340 KOMY Watsonville. It's 11 a.m., time for USA Radio News.
USA Radio Network News. I'm Kurt Lewis. It's all things 1940 style in Washington, D.C. today as the nation's capital hosts the dedication of the National World War II Memorial. It's the first full formal monument dedicated to the greatest generation, which survived childhood and the Great Depression only to have to fight their young adult years in the cause of freedom. Today on the National Mall in D.C., tens of thousands of World War II veterans are gathering for the dedication.
Arthur Van Cook landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day. He came to the dedication from his home in Springfield, Virginia.
I look upon this as a memorial to those we left behind, and I'm here to pay my respects.
The memorial has actually been open for about a month. Planners wanted as many veterans to see it as possible. Of the 16 million Americans who fought during the war, only about 4 million are still alive today. Gene Coletta, Washington.
A few of the many World War II veterans on the mall today have names we recognize, including the longtime Kansas senator and presidential candidate Bob Dole.
We lose about 1,200 a day. We've gone from 16 million plus to 4 million. We've sort of become the disappearing generation.
To this day, Dole lives with a disfigured arm, which was grievously wounded in combat as he fought with U.S. Army forces in Europe 6 decades ago. 150,000 minimum are on the mall today. This is USA Radio News.
KSCO, Santa Cruz, San Jose, Salinas, and Monterey.
Good morning, Central Coast. You're listening to AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz, AM 1340 KOMY Watsonville, KSCO.com. It's 5 minutes past 11 a.m. Scott Free here with your Central Coast weather forecast for today, Saturday, May 29th. It's going to be mostly sunny today with highs in the 60s at the coast to the lower 80s inland and northwest winds 5 to 10 miles an hour, increasing 10 to 20 miles per hour by this afternoon. Tonight you can expect mostly clear conditions with some patchy low clouds and fog spreading inland overnight. Lows will be in the 40s to the lower 50s and northwest winds 5 to 10 miles an hour. And tomorrow and Memorial Day, it's going to be nice and sunny and warmer inland with highs in the 60s at the coast, 90s inland, and north winds 5 to 10 miles an hour on Sunday, 5 to 15 miles per hour on Monday. Currently at 61 degrees. Here at KSCO Radio, time to return to hour two of the very special Saturday Special.
Oh, hello, darling. I hate to hang up on you, but I'm sorry, baby, but I have to go. It's time for that wonderful record show. I'd love to visit, but you'll have to call back. KSCO has the inside track.
Scott, it's not true. How can we play records on a radio station where there's no phonograph in the control room?
We're in the digital age now.
Ew. This is Charlie Friedman, and it's not digital today. We're talking with real live human beings who took part in World War II and gave their last ounce and gave their best for their country and saved us from a fate literally worse than death. And I want to once again thank, let me see, we've got Howard and Bud, and let me see, you were Walter, and Rick, and Chuck, and Bill, and Rainey, who are all here having fulfilled various duties at various times in various places. During the break, we had Rick Ricketts talking about the Reuben James and her role in getting the United States into World War II. I was wondering if you might be willing to share a little of that with our listeners, please.
Yes, well, my destroyer was tied up right next to the Reuben James just before it got sunk, and we were out on the same convoy, but evidently the Winslow was ordered to venture off somewhere else to investigate maybe a sinking or something. But
now, what is the date on this? This is an important part.
It was before 1941. I would say a couple months before Pearl Harbor was bombed.
This is why you were attaching importance to this. This is one of the things that helped get us into the war, because this is before Pearl Harbor.
That's right, Pearl Harbor. The USS Reuben James was sunk, and USS Kearney was damaged and torpedoed. Those were the two things that happened before Pearl Harbor. So we were actually at war before Pearl Harbor in the North Atlantic, convoying the old coal burners across the Atlantic. And I was on a few convoys, and then eventually we went down to blockade the South Atlantic, our destroyer. But it seemed like the stray coal burner that wandered off by himself that couldn't keep up, he always got torpedoed first.
Oh, yeah, any stragglers from a convoy would be fair game for one of Schicklgruber's wolf pack. We also mentioned that even before that, a couple of years before that, the United States Navy gunboat Panay was attacked and destroyed by the Japanese in China.
Yeah.
And this is another one of the outrages that we suffered at the hands of these militarists and dictators before Pearl Harbor finally convinced the American people once and for all that it was time to do serious business with them.
And then, we had the Atlantic Charter when Churchill came over here on the Prince of Wales to beg Roosevelt to declare war, and he said no, Congress had to do it. And so Congress declared World War II, but we're into a war right now that hasn't been declared, that was declared by the White House. So it's a different war.
Well, the Congress did authorize it in October of 2002, so there was a vote taken on it. I wanted to ask Walter, you mentioned that you'd been active in all this, again, before Pearl Harbor, and you were working in the New York shipyards at Camden, New Jersey. Is that correct? And go ahead and send the microphone over there to Walter so he can share a couple of things with us about that. Now, by the time you were involved in the D-Day landings and in the actions in the Pacific, you were a specialist or one of the specialists in amphibious operations. But before that, you were helping to build them, right, over in Camden.
Yes. Camden was a highly industrial town. And the unions were local ones, Camel Soup, RCA, and New York Shipbuilding Corporation. And they built five light carriers. Some of them were light cruisers, and they put a deck on them and made them into carriers.
Were these what they called the escort carriers or jeep carriers?
That's right, yeah. And they also built the South Dakota, which was shot down 38 Japanese planes, and also heavy cruisers. And there, after I came back from the war, they took the heavy cruisers and made them into missile ships. And I didn't know what they were.
Well, the light cruiser,
just a piece of pipe, big pipe. But anyway, I served my apprenticeship there as a ship's carpenter.
The light cruiser that I was stationed on was a World War II vintage ship, and they'd removed the after 6-inch mount and put on a Talos missile launcher. So there was a lot of those conversions done.
Right.
We're going to go ahead and take a phone call or two from some of our listeners. Millie on line one. According to this, Millie, were you actually at the Battle of the Bulge yourself?
I was not in the battle, but I was an ambulance driver picking up wounded at various stations in the vicinity of Bastogne. Do you want me to tell you how it started?
I'd love you to.
Well, in 1944, I was trained at the Navy Automotive School at Treasure Island in San Francisco Bay, for those who don't know that place.
I was stationed there myself.
Okay, maybe we saw each other. No, I don't think so, because you're much younger than I am.
Yep, I'm just a kid.
I'm pushing 80 this summer. Trained for heavy equipment driving. I was still 19 when this all started. In September of 1944, a call went out for volunteer ambulance drivers for the European theater after D-Day. I volunteered, having the credentials and training. We debarked at Le Havre in early October 1944 and headed north, along with all these other supply vehicles, which was a travesty in itself, that Antwerp wasn't open at that time. And so everything had to be slowly carried from Cherbourg Harbor, heading north, so at any rate, toward Belgium, Holland. My group, after we got to the general area, we were housed in some village farmhouse on the outskirts of Bastogne, weeks before the battle commenced. And we were further trained while we were there. I think I just said this about the supply stuff, but
right.
Before Antwerp was opened and the Schelde estuary supplies were trucked 300 miles, that's the big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And this is important. From what I heard at the time, the slow process allowed the Germans to regroup, dig in, whatever. For this surprise attack, I guess the first place they attacked was Bastogne. You know, it's been 60 years, and I can't remember all of it. And one very tragic thing that happened was, I'm sure you've heard of the 101st Parachute Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
After the drops, hundreds, maybe thousands, I don't know the figure, perished after they hit the frozen, it was the coldest winter in 100 years, frozen ground, because they had no winter gear. Can you believe that?
That is unbelievable.
They had not. They didn't have it. And it was like 2 weeks before the 4th Armored Division rescued them. And by rescued them, I mean supplies came in mm-hmm. and helped the venue. Okay.
And those were the battered bastards of Bastogne.
Yeah, well, there were other soldiers in there other than the 101st. But at any rate, after the battle commenced, we picked up wounded at various first aid stops. Some of them were in the woods and thickets and things, some along the horribly icy roads, I'll say,
mm-hm,
were in tents. And then larger houses were used for what was called the evac centers. And some evac centers were in tents, too. But some of these old buildings were used as hospitals. And so everybody regrouped because we regrouped further on down the line to a large convoy area where the decisions were made regarding whether the wounded would be airlifted to England, to the U.S., some would be entrained.
Do you happen to remember about how many of these wounded you were able to recover?
No, I have no clue.
Just working so hard, you didn't have time to keep
count. The ambulance was filled every hour
time.
Of the day, but it was always in convoys.
Well, I appreciate your calling and telling us about this,
I have
this,
a little
Millie.
More. Can I finish it?
Okay.
Okay. Some went entrained to Cherbourg, to hospitals, either in hospital ships, either to the U.S. or to England. As I said before, the rescues were tragically delayed because of the icy roads and enemy fire, which brings that me to the point where I was put out of business. So on or about, I can't even remember, January 5th, my convoy was hit. Many of the wounded were killed and wounded, and along with their drivers, along with a corpsman. I was blown out of the truck mercilessly, not through the windshield, but there were no seat belts in those days.
No.
Onto the ground. My corpsman was killed instantly. And so as a result of a spinal injury, I've walked with a cane for 60 years now. I awakened in a hospital ship and headed for the U.S., and that was it.
My goodness.
But I must say that after the experiences of seeing these beautiful young men and older men with their faces partially blown off, lost all their limbs, everything else, because of the horrors of war, I became a lifetime pacifist. And I know that all these years I've been calling on the radio, and I have given a strong impression that I am a pacifist, and I am. And when the tragic, stupid, I think, Vietnam War started, I really started working actively for peace and for the end of that war.
Okay, Millie, this is I want to thank you very much for calling and sharing your experiences in Europe. It's an incredible story you have to tell.
Yeah, it was, happened so long ago and far away, but it happened.
Well, I'm particularly glad that we had, there were plenty of women in World War II. This is something we tend to forget because in those days we didn't allow, quote, women in combat. On the other hand, even though you didn't have a combat role, I'd say you were getting shot at pretty good and proper.
Oh, yeah, we were moving targets, you know. Hello?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
a lot of nurses were killed and injured in those tents.
Well, thank you very much for doing what you did and for calling in today and telling us about it.
It was a pleasure. We are going to have the 60th anniversary, which is December 16th, of the Battle of the Bulge Vets in December to celebrate the 60th, which is another celebration beyond D-Day.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank
Bill
you.
Nolan will probably be there. He's a Bulge veteran himself.
Yeah, I have the names of a lot of guys. Okay, goodbye.
Bye-bye, Millie, and thanks again for calling. I appreciate it. We will we'll take a break now, and we'll come back on the radio in just a couple of minutes. I'm Charlie Friedman with 7 World War II veterans of various campaigns and various services, and we'll be back in a few. Our telephone number is 479-1080 if you wish to join the program.
News you can use and talk that's red hot. KSCO, Santa Cruz, San Jose, Salinas, and Monterey.
You're listening to KSCO, serving Aptos, Sand City, and Bitterwater.
It's the Memorial Day weekend, so get out the sunglasses and the suntan lotion and head to Watsonville for the 40th annual fly-in and air show, the largest event of its kind in the West, with over 300 classic aircraft on display and skies filled with tumbling, twisting, shining flying machines. Meet NASA astronauts, see evening fireworks, eat great food, and mingle with fun people. Get out the sunglasses and suntan lotion and head to Watsonville this weekend for the 40th annual fly-in and air show.
When most people eat, they don't consider what happens to their food after it's been swallowed. Calories and nutrients are taken by the digestive system to feed our bodies, but what happens when we can't absorb the nutrients we ingest? Here's pharmacist Benjamin Fuchs to tell us how to better digest our food.
Food and digestion is the hardest thing that we do to our bodies on a regular basis, trying to digest our food. It creates a lot of stress in the body and produces a lot of toxins in the body as well. So a food holiday is always a good idea, no matter what your health issue is, or even if you're just plain healthy, it's a good idea to take a break from food once a week. And when you take a break from food, you want to make sure that you're drinking lots of veggie juices. Did you know just chewing your food appropriately can be a wonderful way to eliminate inflammatory conditions and can be a wonderful way to improve longevity? Just simply chewing your food can allow food to be digested more appropriately. The less we eat, the better. Now, there's different kinds of digestive enzymes. Proteolytic enzymes can have some really important effects, most especially for helping reduce inflammation. In fact, Bromelain and papain alone have been shown to reduce inflammation in, due to trauma, but you also get secondary benefits, and that is improved digestion. Improved digestion can help eliminate toxins that make it into the bloodstream. Those toxins can actually be simply pieces of food that didn't get digested. So digestive enzymes are a wonderful strategy for taking care of that, and the digestive enzymes should be taken before meals.
Balance out your digestive system by taking American Longevity's Ultimate Enzymes. Each bottle contains a proprietary enzyme complex formulated to support all aspects of digestion, aids in detoxification, and at $19 a bottle wholesale, you'll be properly digesting fats and proteins without eating away your hard-earned dough. Give your body what it needs for proper digestive health. American Longevity's Ultimate Enzymes. To order or to pick up American Longevity products, please call 1-831-425-3090. That number again is 1-831-425-3090.
Buying a home around here is an expensive proposition. Hi, I'm Jim Chubb with Pacific Inland. I've been helping people save money on home loans for nearly 20 years, and I'd like to help you save money on your next home purchase. Right now, Pacific Inland has special programs that are helping people save real money when they buy a home. Call Pacific Inland at 831-475-2600, and we'll tailor one of these programs to help you buy a home. That's Pacific Inland at 475-2600, licensed by the California Department of Real Estate.
You're listening to KSCO, serving Salinas, San Juan, Bautista, and Lockwood.
Well, gentlemen, now I can tell you that we're going to Tokyo. And we're going to bomb it. Yeah! It comes as a special request directly from President Roosevelt. The Navy's going to sneak us about 400 miles off the Japanese coast, and we'll launch from the carrier there.
Has that ever even been done before? Taking Army bombers off of Navy carriers?
No.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Well, sir, is it even possible to land a B-25 on an aircraft carrier deck?
That won't matter. As soon as we're airborne, the carrier will head straight back for Hawaii.
But if the carriers head home, where do we land?
I have a phrase I want you to memorize. War shore yiga me goren. It means I am an American. In Chinese.
I particularly like that one guy who questioned, has that ever been done before, taking Army bombers off of Navy carriers?
No.
Okay. That's the kind of spirit that I have around here. That's the kind of spirit that these men had when they went out to fight that most brutal of all wars, World War II. I'm going to get right back to the subject matter here. We had a caller, Marco, in Santa Cruz. Says his father was a gunner on a B-25 and had a ball, it says here. Did any guests have a similar experience? Is this Marco here on line two?
Hello, is that me?
Is this Marco?
Yeah, it is. Sorry.
Great. Yes, we do have a fellow here by the name of Chuck Jugan, who was a tail gunner. And Chuck, if you move that microphone over to yourself there, I think maybe you could help Marco out with a few reminiscences.
Yeah, Marco, this is Chuck Jugan. I was on a B-24 bomber. I was in the Navy, and we were land-based. Everybody thinks you're a sailor, you was going to be aboard ship, but I never saw a ship until the war was over. But the B-25s had a top deck turret on the B-25, and they modified that aircraft into many different versions.
Right, that's right.
To suit the occasion of the war. As a matter of fact, I remember when I was in North Island, California, I was getting ready to depart for the South Pacific, and they were experimenting with B-25s, and they put a 75-millimeter in the nose of that aircraft, and they had a revetment there at the end of the runway. When they fired that 75-millimeter, it fired all the way back through the tail, and they found out that was satisfactory gun for that operation. So you say your dad was on an aircraft?
Yeah, I had two questions, actually. My father was a side gunner on a B-25.
Yeah, I think he had two side gunners, too.
Yeah, and he doesn't talk about the war very often, but I was down there about a month ago, and he started talking a little bit about it. And he said that, he was just amongst a bunch of kids that were 18, 19 years old, and they were having a ball, was his description of his early war experience, I suppose, when he was up in the plane shooting at other aircraft.
Was that?
I was just wondering if that was a sort of a common thing that a certain number of the soldiers that were in the Air Force or that weren't really in direct fire were, in essence, almost enjoying themselves.
Well, that's true. We were all young kids, and we just graduated out of high school, and we were ready for the new life was coming up, and very exciting.
Right, right.
As a matter of fact, one of our training missions, we flew a three-plane formation right down the Grand Canyon, and our wingtips just barely grazed the edge of the canyon.
How about that?
And
wow.
I thought that was excellent.
Yeah, great. Yeah, he also talked about how cold it was on the aircraft, because he said there was no pressurization at 20,000 feet.
Right.
They were up there freezing.
42 degrees below zero.
Yeah, wow, wow. I had one other question, and that's my father and my uncle both went off to war, and my uncle flew a fighter plane, I guess a P-47 or something like that.
Yeah, they had a P-47 Thunderbolt.
And I'm just wondering how many families sent two sons off to war, and both of them came back without a serious injury.
Yeah, that's true. We had three brothers in World War II, two in the Army, and I was in the Navy.
Mm.
We all come back home.
Well, we honor your service.
Well, it was our pleasure.
Yeah, and I have a new respect for Millie, too. It just goes to show you that you can't really know anything about people or judge people because you don't know their past experiences and what they've done in their life.
That's correct.
And I think Millie just made it clear that that there are people that have done things that would surprise all of us.
That's correct.
Well, thank you again.
You're quite welcome.
Thanks for calling, Marco. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. I really appreciate the veterans. Thank you.
Thanks again, and some great questions and points you made. I appreciate your call. If this is jogging your memory and you have something you'd like to contribute or ask, we'd be pleased to hear from you. The telephone number here is 479-1080. If you'd be so kind as to push that microphone over here to Howard Bittner, we had a caller who offered a comment, said he just heard that it's a possibility that Pat Tillman, this actually works into something else. We had another caller who'd asked if current celebrities or stars would be as willing as a man like Glenn Miller was to go into combat. And I was thinking, well, what about Pat Tillman, who was a man who had a bright career in the NFL ahead of him and gave all that up to go into the service and do his bit? And now the question here is, was Pat Tillman killed in Afghanistan by friendly fire? He asked for comments about friendly fire, and the reason I'd like you to respond to this, Howard, is because before the program we were talking about this, and you were talking about some firsts that you saw, and you mentioned that one of the first things you saw was a friendly fire accident. Could you help us out with that?
On the night of the 7th, we sent our fighter planes in to land on Ford Island. We'd been standing off because at the attack that morning, we were still 100 miles out. We sent our fighter planes in, and by that time, everyone on Ford Island had a firearm of some sort, and they shot down five of those seven or nine planes, killed two pilots. Friendly fire, December the 7th.
Right at the beginning of the war. Does anybody else have anything they can share on this that possibly witnessed a friendly fire accident or heard tell of one? I noticed that our friend Rick is pulling over a microphone there.
Well, quickly here. The USS Winslow that I was served on, we were in Puerto Rico. Okay, we got a radiogram or radio communication that a U-boat is attacking the island of Aruba. So we went there as fast as we could, and we arrived, and in the middle of the night, it's dark. So there was a new kid on the radar. Radar was in its infancy at the time. Infancy, and he thought that the island itself was the U-boat on the surface. So we started firing as much as we could, and I was a loader on a 5-inch at the time, and I was setting the fuses on the star shells, and so we must have got 100 rounds out of the 5-inch before the gunnery officer come down on the hammer and beat on the mount, say, cease fire, we're shooting up the island itself and not the U-boat. So that's one of my quick stories there about friendly fire.
I notice it looks like Bud Murray has something to offer on this too. Bud?
Yeah, we were on the island New Georgia, and we're taking what they call the Munda Airstrip. And one regiment, the 147th, I believe it was a regiment, it was in part of our division. But we used to put out markers for aircraft. In other words, we'd lay out these markers to show the aircraft when they're coming over where to bomb. Later on, they replaced them with, we got a some technician or something from the Air Force, and he'd be with us with the radio. But anyway, they laid out the markers. But what happened is the Japanese noticed the markers, and they retreated. They went back. The guys not knowing that, but they decided, and they forward they went, way above the markers. The next thing you know, the Navy come in and just blasted the hell out of that entire regiment. Okay. They were replaced with another regiment.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's... Jeez, you know, you hear stories like that, and it just makes you shake your head. But given the technologies that were available at the time, and friendly fire accidents happen nowadays with all the, as Bill was pointing out, we have all these satellite communications and GPS global positioning, etc. But in World War II, friendly fire accidents must have been much more common due to the technologies that you men had to work with.
Yeah, we was coming up from a raid up the north end of Bougainville. And there are two aircraft going along the beach, two fighter planes. See, all our aircraft there were Navy,
mm-hmm.
a whole bunch of them, except for the New Zealanders. They had a squadron. But we noticed it. There was two Higgins boats. We noticed the planes going along there. But one of the damn things peeled off, come over, and started to strafe our Higgins.
Oh, my God.
And he only stopped from no further than the width of this table. He stopped there. Now, when we come back from the raid, they told us that they had put the two guys on suspension or some darn thing. I don't know what they did with them. But if he'd kept going, you know how you're packed into those little Higgins,
mm-hmm.
he could have wiped out that whole boat.
And none of that stuff ever gets in an official record. It's all covered up.
Yeah.
All of it or just a lot of it?
I know that the Winslow, none of that was in an official log, where 100 rounds were fired into this island. I had a future brother-in-law that was on the island at the time. He said that one of the shells hit a house, and a couple of women had, one woman in particular had a miscarriage, and another woman had a birthmark baby and blamed it on the U.S. Navy and stuff like that.
Walter, I notice you have something on this.
Yeah, well, we went on a mock invasion before the real invasion, and we were in convoy with several LSTs. Two German E-boats snuck in and sunk both of these LSTs. And what happened is most of the soldiers on those LSTs had rubber
life jackets
around their middle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had ammunition and rifles, and you know, they had a lot of stuff on them.
Don't tell me they started floating
and
upside down.
That's what happened.
Oh, yeah, my God, no.
It was more casualties in that one 10 or 15 minutes than anything that happened in World War II.
Oh, my God. Clarify for those of the people in the audience who aren't familiar with an LST. The letters stand for Landing Ship Tank. If you've seen photographs or recreations or anything of amphibious landings from D-Day to the Pacific, you've seen landing craft. These are amphibious craft. They're capable of traveling through the water and then making landings. The landing ship tank doesn't actually go on land. It's the largest of the landing craft. The reason it's called a landing ship tank is because it carries full-size tanks, and it's got these huge doors in the bow. And when they land it, they push it as far in as they can, and these doors swing open, and a ramp comes out. And the next thing you know, you've got mechanized equipment heading out on that beach. So an LST is going to be carrying a tremendous number of men because this is a big landing craft. This is not like one of those little things you see that has, you know, maybe 20, 40, 50 guys in it. This is going to be hundreds of men.
Well, you know, they have a...
Grab the microphone there, bud.
Yeah. They have, when they come into land, they have a giant winch in the back of them, and they throw out an anchor. And then they go up, they hit the beach. Now, on several occasions, we had them where they hit the beach, and they had a young lieutenant that was in charge of it, and he outran the anchor.
Oh, my God.
they tried with the engineers to bring down a cat to get the thing off, and he says, no, they do too much damage to the front of it. So they finally got, I guess it was a destroyer escort or want them to come in and tow it off. They got it off. That's how they come off the beach.
We've got a caller on the line, George and Gonzalez, who has something to say about friendly fire. And I guess, George, you were in Vietnam, correct?
Yes, I was an infantryman in Vietnam, and I just wanted to say it's an honor to be able to reminisce with these guys from the last good war that we had, you know, the last war that wasn't exactly politically correct. And I just wanted to tell you that everybody out here sure does honor you guys for what you've done. You know, in Vietnam, we fought a war that wasn't exactly popular, but we were doing what we thought we were supposed to be doing, and I think everybody that's out there today is doing what they think is they're supposed to be doing. And it's just an honor to be able to glean some information from you guys who were just, as you say, kids, because I was just a kid then, too. And it didn't seem like we were doing anything really magnificent or terrific at the time, and I'm sure you felt the same way. And then when you look back on it and people hear about the episodes that you had, how wonderful it is that that you are back home and you are able to tell your stories.
Thank you very much for your call, George. I'm sure everybody here appreciates it.
You bet. Take care of yourself, and God bless all of you guys, okay?
Thanks a lot. George and Gonzalez, if you want to be on the program, we'll have some time after the next break, which is going to come up in just a moment here. Let's see here. Re-World War II Memorial in D.C. cost to construct. Can you explain why only $16 million of the $450 million was funded by the government? There have been an awful lot of memorials of this sort that have been funded by private contributions over the years. One of the stories that my mother used to tell me when I was young was how the USS Constitution, Old Ironsides, the oldest commissioned ship in the U.S. Navy, a frigate that fought in the War of 1812, and, you know, iron men and wooden ships, it was in the 1930s that this ship, of course, having been in the water for 150 years, was deteriorating. The oak planks were rotting, etc., and a decision was taken to refurbish the ship. And it was done without any government assistance. Young school children and other people across the country took up contributions. They collected pennies, nickels, and dimes, and they raised the money it took to restore and refurbish the USS Constitution, which then made a voyage around the United States of America through the Panama Canal and actually made a port call at Eureka, where my mother was in those days, and she has a picture of the ship as it was in Eureka Harbor. So for things of this sort to be funded by private contribution or conscription is nothing new, and I think it's a wonderful thing that the American people step up and do something like this. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, and Howard is champing at the bit. He's got something to share with you as soon as we get back. This is the Saturday Special. I'm Charlie Friedman with 7 World War II vets.
You're listening to KSCO, serving Scotts Valley, Gonzales, and New Idra.
Over $3 million of fine art jewelry, Rolex watches, gold coins, Persian rugs, historical documents, luxury furs, collectible and bronze sculptures must be sold at Liquidation Auction this Saturday, May 29th. United States Liquidators is auctioning original works of art by Pablo Picasso, Joan Miró, Raúl Dufay, Maurice Utrillo, Camille Pissarro, Louis Eichardt, H. Behrens, Tarkai, H. Claude, and Palomil Pissarro, and more. Original bronze sculptured by Angelo Basso and Ert. Pencils signed Picasso, Chagall, Miró, Dalí, and others. Over 20 Armani, Yadro, Hummel, and Santini figurines. Over 200 lots of fine jewelry, large certified diamond solitaires, 2 to 15 carats. Rolex Presidentials, Cartier, Patek Philippe, Piaget, and others. Masterpiece, handmade rugs, Tabriz, Isfahan, Kashan, Kerman, Ariz, and more. All to be offered at auction this Saturday, May 29th in the Seascape Resort Aptos. Preview at noon starts at 1 p.m. Most items sold with no minimum and no reserve. For more information, call 1-800-738-6790. 1-800-738-6790.
My name is Troy, and I met my fiancé on eHarmony.com.
My name is Tom, and I met my fiancée, Brenda, on eHarmony.com.
My name is Jack, and I met my wife, Jennifer, on eHarmony.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Neil Clark Warren, founder of eHarmony.com. These are just a few of the thousands of eHarmony matches. Dating services give you a picture in a paragraph. We go a lot deeper. We start with a personality profile that features 29 dimensions of compatibility, crucial to a long-term relationship. And if you go to eHarmony.com right now, we'll give you this $40 profile free. and then we'll find you a soulmate based on compatibility in the most important areas of life. Visit eHarmony.com today and get your free personality profile.
Hi, my name's Daniel, and I found my fiancée Allison at eHarmony.com.
A lot of happy couples out there tonight, thanks to eHarmony.com.
We feel it the first day our kids learn the word no. We're reminded of it every time we read the headlines or when doing battle with the stack of papers on our desk. But before the world defeats us, maybe it's time to consider another way. Hello, I'm Meg Lumsdaine, host of the Leap to Faith radio program, with an invitation to join me and my guests, Pastors Clark Brown and Herb Schmidt, as we discuss the promised powers for those who believe. We'll talk about what transformed the disciples of Jesus to change their world, and see how we can overcome the barriers to the Spirit that keep us bound. It's Leap to Faith, Saturday at 2 p.m. on 1080 KSCO.
Oh my God, my liver! Oh my God,
so
my
come
liver.
On, Wade.
Tell us what to do. Tell us how to fix you.
What can we do, Wade? Tell us what to do.
I could use a little morphine.
Thank you very much, Scott. Welcome back to the last segment of today's Saturday special. We had a couple of interesting facts here, one in which somebody is denouncing pacifists and pacifism. Well, I can understand where you're coming from. There are certain times when it's time to get out the old gun, but the idea of calling all pacifists cowards doesn't really strike me as being fair or reasonable. Another one here. I would rather have a German division in front of me than a French one behind me, said General George S. Patton. That reminds me of one of my favorite quotes, I'd rather have a free bottle in front of me than a prefrontal lobotomy. And, of course, I'll lay this one open. Any of you gentlemen know why the French have so many tree-lined country roads? Nobody? It's because Germans like to march in the shade. Okay, now that we've disposed of that... We had a comment, let me see, Stephen Aptos asked if you could comment more on the horrors of war. The little sound segment that Scott played just to introduce this final segment with those sounds of people wounded in agony brings this very much to mind. I think we already had one of the gentlemen here mention that a lot of people who are involved in the war don't talk that much about it. My father was a veteran, was over in the Italian theater. He talked about the time he got to meet General Mark Clark once, but insofar as the actual war, he's very reticent about discussing it, and I don't think that's a strange thing. And I think when somebody asks you, what are the stories that you can tell me about somebody who's been horribly wounded or killed or something like that, does anybody here actually really enjoy discussing that, or is it something that you feel sometimes you have to do? Anybody who has something to say on this, just grab a microphone and respond, please.
Well, I was wounded.
Yeah. This is Bud Murray.
Yeah. I was wounded, but in fact, is when I got wounded, I got shot in the one of our pillboxes, and I couldn't do anything about it. And I went up and rescued one of our sergeants. He'd been shot. He had been shot up in the left, right up there by the collarbone.
Mm-hmm.
And when I come down the hill and I went over, he was yelling at me to come and help him. So I went up there and I had to drag him down through the trench into the pillbox. And he said, "Well, get my gun." So I went back up the hill and got his gun, brought it back down. And I tried my best to try to keep him alive, keep him going, but he died. Later on, I found out from the medic when he come down here, he says, "Well, you don't have to worry, buddy." He says, "You did all you could." He
right.
got shot with a wooden bullet, which I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. The Japanese had him, and it splintered. And a couple of the splinters right into his heart.
Oh, my God.
So he died. And I don't mind talking about when I got wounded. I got shot in the leg, and I couldn't get out of the pillbox for 5 days because the Japs had us pinned in because they could shoot right down on us.
Now, you mentioned you were island hopping. Which island was this?
This is on Bougainville.
Bougainville.
Yeah. And
I couldn't get out of there, so I had to treat myself. See, you have your little band-aid or little things with you, you know. Mm-hmm. And I treated myself with that for 5 days, and when the medic got down there, he looked at me and says, "Hell, you've done whatever could be done."
Absolutely.
Take a tourniquet? A tourniquet?
No, I didn't bleed that bad. Really, I didn't get into the muscle, or, well, I got into the muscle, but I didn't hit the bone or anything, fortunately. And it was a clean wound, you know what I mean.
We were talking just before the break about how they raised most of the funds for the World War II Memorial from private subscriptions, and I had mentioned how years earlier the money to restore old Ironsides was raised the same way. And Howard, you mentioned that one of the inspirations for that was a poem. I had forgotten about that. You're correct.
Yes, there was a poem called Old Ironsides, and it started off with a sort of indication of shame. It said, "I tear her tattered ensign down, long has it waved on high, and many an eye has danced to see that banner in the sky." And it goes on, and the last lines are, "'Tis better that her shattered hulk should sink beneath the wave, her thunder shook the mighty deep, and there should be her grave." And in a way, this may have shamed the American public, because immediately the money poured in, and we have Old Ironsides today at an East Coast harbor.
Mm-hmm. Boston Harbor. Boston Harbor. We have Bob listener on line two. Bob, it's good to hear from you, and I guess according to this here, you want to say a word for the boys in the Coast Guard.
Yeah, I was in the Coast Guard for 3 years, 4 months, and 27 days, and in some quarters it has a reputation of not going overseas or being involved in any of the fighting, but I can tell you that I was on an LST in the Coast Guard, as were many others. I was on LST number 24 and participated in 5 invasions in the Pacific. What I was on participated in Guam, Morotai, which is in the Dutch East Indies, which was really an invasion, and Leyte and Luzon, Leyte and Lingayen Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, I'm not going to say that I was a hero, because I wasn't, but we were in 5 invasions. And one convoy I was in, the ship, the LST in front of us blew up. I don't know if it was a submarine or a mine, but I can tell you that it was, we were mighty scared. I was on the I was standing watch on the bow, and I saw it happen. And one of the things that I would like to also mention is a former resident of Santa Cruz, which whom you probably know, Charlie, Dave Tuno.
Yeah, I remember the name. Yeah,
Dave was a resident of Santa Cruz. He was the most decorated airman in World War II. Now lives in Mississippi. And I just wanted to get my licks in on the Coast Guard. We were overseas. We had a lot of boys that were overseas, and somebody already mentioned in the Atlantic, but I was in the Pacific. Many of us on LSTs, attack transports, destroyer escorts, and sub-tenders were manned by the Coast Guard. And I wanted to get that in.
Well, Bob, I have at home a number of Bob Hope monologues, and one of them he's addressing a Coast Guard crowd. And he's, let me see, what's the gag? He's saying, people have the idea that the Coast Guard, you know, doesn't have much to do with this. He says, that's not true. He says, once the Marines get a beachhead well in hand, the Coast Guard are right there charging tourists 10 cents apiece to sail by and look at it.
That's exactly right. I just happened to mention the name of a Coast Guardman that died recently, who was on one of the attack transports in the Atlantic. His name was Leo Greenberg.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm glad you chose to remember him here.
And there's a lot of us who were in the Coast Guard who spent time overseas. They used to call it the Navy. Some of the Navy people used to refer to us as the Hooligan Navy.
I love that.
When we used to go ashore, we had some brawls over that.
Oh, I'll bet. Geez, that's almost as bad as walking up to a Marine and starting to mouth off about jarheads.
Yes, I'm willing to confess one thing. Because of the Hooligan Navy appellation that was directed at us, I got into a brawl with my buddies, and I got into a brawl with some Navy guys, and I ended up in the brig for 9 days.
yeah, but who won the fight?
I don't want to brag or anything, but we did.
All right. Thanks, Bob, for calling in. I appreciate hearing from you today. Bob Listener, reminding us all of the contribution made by the Coast Guard. We have another caller on line one, Paul in Royal Oaks. He has something to say about the Battle of Monte Cassino. Paul, thank you very much for calling this morning.
Hey, you're welcome, Stan. You're welcome. Gentlemen, my hat's off to you. Thank you very much for everything you did for us and for America. My dad was in the Battle of Monte Cassino, and he was taken prisoner for about 18 months, and then he was freed. When he got home in the late 80s, in the 90s, he went into surgery, but he was a gentleman that, like a lot of men, wouldn't go to the hospital, didn't want anything to do with a doctor. But then one day the doctor approached him and told him, Pete, you were a POW. Everything, as far as your medical, is free. And ever since then, he wasn't afraid to go to the doctor, but I found it rather ironic that it took him that long to find that out about being a POW and his entitlements. The point I wanted to ask about is, could you, gentlemen, mention anything about Monte Cassino and anything that would pertain to that, as far as some reminiscence? I'll hang up and listen off here.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Appreciate it. Well, how about it, gentlemen? Is anybody here who was anybody anywhere near that particular battle or knew anybody who was?
I watched the History Channel. I watched the History Channel the other night, and they had a whole deal on that, on the Monte Cassino deal. I think it was the Polish troops that finally got into the Monte Cassino.
Okay. Anybody else have anything to contribute on this one? Okay. Rainey, I remember you were mentioning that you were involved in what theater was it? You were in the Battle of the Bulge also, weren't
you? Yes, European Theater.
Okay. Were you connected at all with General McAuliffe?
Not to my recollection.
Okay. He being the one who got the famous line off when the Germans came to him and demanded his surrender, his response was nuts.
Oh, now I get you. That was... he had an airborne unit in Bastogne.
Uh-huh.
And when the Germans wanted him to surrender, that's when he says, nuts. McAuliffe?
Right, McAuliffe.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure of the name.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. McAuliffe. Yeah, he was in Bastogne there, too. And our battalion, part of it, left Metz, France, and hit north, and we got in Bastogne Christmas Eve at about 1 o'clock in the morning. And we set up our outer guard, but we seen a figure walking out in the snow. It was Bedcheck Charlie, the flyer, German flyer. He got shot down, so we took him into camp.
What happened to him then?
Well, AMPs got him in the morning.
Oh, okay, so he became a POW at that point.
Another thing I'd like to bring up is these people in the glider units that supposed to land in Holland. And I think practically the whole unit perished when they landed. Does that sound familiar to you people?
I have heard something about that. I don't know that. Does anybody here have any information on the glider pilots? I know there was a motion picture that came out about it one time, just made the point that these guys just, it was a horrible meat grinder. Nobody came back.
It seemed to me that they had landed in the wrong area.
Mm-hmm.
And the Germans had put some stakes in where they're supposed to land. And when they come down, the gliders hit those stakes, and that was the end of the whole unit.
Just got torn to pieces.
Yes.
Oh, my God. We got Al in Santa Cruz on the line. Al wants to talk about the Merchant Marine. We already had one fellow mention that. Al, do you have a story you can add to that, please?
Well, I just wanted to put in a few words for my uncle, who was in the Merchant Marine.
This is a good time to do it. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, pretty much throughout World War II. And I don't know if you know this. There's actually a very good documentary that was done a few years back about the Merchant Marine. It's got a bunch of interviews from people up in the Bay Area. But their chances of getting killed were higher than the Marines initially. And I know my uncle went out. He did some stuff in the North Atlantic and then also in the Caribbean. But they sent out ships that didn't even have guns on them. They just, had painted telephone poles.
Well, early on, before they perfected convoy techniques, being a merchant marine sailor was really, something that you better have your insurance paid up before you start doing.
Yeah, incredibly dangerous. But the other part is they really got screwed, too, because I know after he got out of that, he got drafted and ended up in the Army in the Korean War.
Oh, my gosh.
But also just wanted to say my dad, too, spent a lot of time troop transports. He was in the Coast Guard and protecting convoys throughout the South Pacific and then also India and I think into the Mediterranean at one point, too.
Well, thank you very much for calling and talking about that here today. Al, we appreciate
okay.
it. And Rick, I notice you're reaching for the microphone.
Well, I just want to say about the Merchant Marine. It was awful hard for them to get any sailors to man those old coal burners in the early part of 1941 to go across the Drink to Scotland. As a matter of fact, there was some of those ships left with only 8 or 9 crew members on them.
Oh, my God.
And you're supposed to get $500 if you get over there, bonus, and $500 bonus. This is a bonus on the way back. And even that, I couldn't get enough sailors to demand them.
And it should be mentioned that in those days, $500 went a lot farther than it does now. Howard, you've got something that that you wanted to get out?
Yeah, I'm sure that you have a closing in mind, but I just wanted to say that there's many guys who can't be here today because they're in bed someplace. And I have a friend. I said that I would mention this when I talked to him yesterday.
Please do.
He's in a constant care place. His name is Richard Mullen. Get well, Richard.
Anybody else have any particular people you'd like to remember? Maybe somebody that you haven't seen for 40 years, 50 years, something of that nature, or somebody else who's convalescing? No? Well, one thing that I noticed in the newspaper this morning was there were 16 million Americans who were involved in the service during World War II. Fortunately, only 220,000 were killed out of 16 million. As we look back on it, or as I look back on it, given that terrible war and how long it lasted and how brutal the fighting was, I'm grateful that so few people were actually killed in combat out of that huge number. But now, those veterans are along in years, and according to what I saw, there's about 4 million of the World War II veterans left, and we're losing them at the rate of about 1,000 a day. Ladies and gentlemen, this Memorial Day would be a good time to take a little time and try to remember the sacrifice these people have made. It saved our country. It saved Western civilization. And if it doesn't mean something to you, then you're not only not an American, you're not even human. This is KSCO Santa Cruz, KOMY Watsonville. I'm Charles Friedman, and I'm going to have to go have a cup of coffee now. Have a good day.
In your eyes, I've earned what all of you have done for me.
While the gods of love look down and laugh at what romantic fools we mortals be.
That's all, folks. KSCO Santa Cruz, KOMY Watsonville.